This is The Takeaway. I'm Tanzina Vega. Jussie Smollett is a Black gay man who plays a Black gay man in the Fox series Empire. In the early hours of Tuesday, he says he was attacked on the street in Chicago by two men who yelled racist and homophobic slurs at him. He also said that his attackers wrapped a rope around his neck. Chicago police are investigating the attack as a hate crime, and others have already moved to define it. Senators Cory Booker and Kamala Harris have both called the alleged attack on Smollett a, quote, attempted modern-day lynching. According to the most recent nationwide data from the FBI, reported hate crimes increased 17% in 2017 from the year before. And when an attack happens, entire communities are affected. To talk about that impact, I'm joined by Tobin Lowe, co-host of the podcast Nancy, which tells stories of the queer experience today, and Rebecca Carroll, cultural critic and editor of Special Projects at WNYC. Welcome, both of you.
Hello.
Thanks, Tanzina.
So I want to start by asking your reactions, and I know, Rebecca, you reacted in writing to hearing about this story of Jussie Smollett. What was your initial feeling in that moment when you heard the story?
I felt so tense. I felt immediately a visceral response and started to sweat and felt so sad and triggered, you know, and immediately started writing. And I didn't even think it was going to be a piece. I just needed to get some words down because it was the rope. It was the rope that really put me over, you know. I mean, Black and brown folks, LGBTQ folks, we hear and see the slurs. We see them online. We hear them on the street. But the rope, to just imagine that, that sort of the tactileness of it, just devastating.
Hmm. Tobin, you?
I think for me, and I think for a lot of queer people, hearing about attacks like this, you start to roll through the Rolodex of experiences that you've had and, you know, times that someone has called you a name, maybe on the train or on the street, and you're like, well, it could have gone another way. You know, like it could have gone violent, or maybe you have had violent experiences in the past. I mean, I think for me, the other thing that I think about is as queer people, we can't not center the fact that Jussie is Black and queer, and that he exists in that specific intersection, and that part of our community experiences so much more harassment. So that's the part that I feel drawn to focus on and to talk about.
Rebecca, you mentioned the rope, and just so you know, we reached out to the Chicago Police Department to learn more about how they're investigating this. We haven't heard back from them yet, but the rope. It's deeply and profoundly painful, and it just reminds me of not just lynchings of Black Americans, but also Matthew Shepard was tied with a rope. We just made lynching illegal in the United States after 200 failed attempts. The rope is significant.
Oh, extremely so. I mean, it's indelible. It is, and it is, you know, I certainly... At the beginning, when we first heard the story, when the news broke, I tweeted certainly about the intersection of it being both homophobic and racist, and then sort of went more into this notion because of the noose and the rope, and because that is such a, you know, implacable part of Black history, slave history. It's in my bones. It's in our bones collectively as Black folks, and so. That, I think, is something that we can't avoid talking about as well, and very specifically and very trenchantly.
This story is deeply uncomfortable for me. I think it triggers, and that word is used a lot, but right, I think this story in particular is really hard to process. Tobin, what is the sort of balance between being out and proud of who you are, and being afraid to be out and proud of who you are, not just because of being queer, but also being a person of color? Like, how do you deal with all of those levels? Do you choose, you know, not to be out and proud because you're afraid of what you can control versus what you can't control?
Yeah, it is tricky because it does feel like it is a potentially dangerous thing to be an out and public person right now. And I think you know, this is something I've talked a lot about with other queer folks, is this idea that, like, when we talk about queer people who are out there, so often we focus on stories of people who are fabulous and really confident and, like, have it all together. And so that forces us to focus on stories where people, you know, are sort of, like, really putting themselves out there and feel really confident. And I think what that doesn't leave as much room for is vulnerability or talking about some of the dangers of being out and proud. So, I mean, stories like this make me think about, you know, there's another side to that.
Similarly, you know, Who Runs the World? Girls, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, that does not allow for a very real vulnerability for Black girls. I mean, we've just gone through this with R. Kelly. You know, Black girls don't really actually matter to a lot of American society and mainstream. So there's this overcompensation, you know, where Beyonce and Black Girl Magic and all this kind of thing. And I worry that it really puts our girls more in danger because there isn't as much conversation about how to create that bridge and how to be confident and step into who you are, but to also be very aware and mindful that there are forces actively working against you.
Mm. And there's also, you know, one of the things, we talked a lot about these emotions. One of the emotions I'm having is anger. I don't know if you guys are feeling the same thing, but the reason why I'm feeling that anger is because it makes me angry that I have to be afraid.
Yeah, I didn't feel, you know, I mean, I felt rage, which I don't know if it's that's really the same thing as anger. I felt rage and I just felt deeply, deeply saddened. I mean, I just could not get the image out of my head of this man who is by all accounts an absolute ray of light, full of love, his colleagues, his fans, his peers, you know, that he's in this moment alone with a rope around his neck. It's just so, so deeply saddening.
What about the trauma? Because I think when we talk about trauma, we don't quite understand it as a community issue, right? We think about it as an individual thing. You went through something, you're suffering through it, it's your trauma. But I think these attacks do affect the rest of our community, right?
Oh, for sure.
Yes.
I absolutely think that the trauma is collective, and I think that it's observed and absorbed in individual ways, but also in collective ways. And I think it's an opportunity too, as Tobin pointed out, for it to be even more inclusively absorbed,
Yes. I mean, even as we sit here, you know, there's different pieces that are triggering for each of us. You know, like Rebecca, you're talking about the lynching aspect of it. You feel it in your soul. And, you know, the homophobic part of it is the thing that, you know, I think about. And, you know, as people of color, we're all sitting here thinking about it. And so it puts us in a room together where we're each talking about our trauma and trying to understand each other's trauma. But I mean, the feeling that I had afterwards is like, oh my God, take your pick of awful things about this attack. There's sort of like too much to focus on and too much to pull apart.
How do we deal with collective trauma? How do we, like, how do traumatized people help each other get out of this or find ways to cope? Because I think one of the things about this is it sort of creates a low-grade or high-grade stress in all of us, right? We're afraid that we may be attacked. We're afraid to say the wrong thing. We're afraid of just living our lives. Like, how do we deal with that in everyday life?
I was really heartened by the sort of solidarity, the national solidarity that it came in response to this. You know, certainly from high-profile folks, Kamala, and the Hollywood community, but also, you know, folks online and social media and Twitter, you know, who aren't as well known, who are struggling with understanding whether or not there needs to be an emphasis on one thing or the other, but are struggling nonetheless. And so I feel like that's, like, you know, Tobin said, take your pick. It's also an absolute resolute example of America embodied in this one incident.
I was going to say also, we talked about the news, but like you said, there are other elements to this that make this almost a textbook moment here for this moment that we're living through. Let's talk a little bit about the language that both was used in that the police are using. I think that was a point of contention, calling this a possible hate crime. Question, though, if the crime is being investigated, right, the cops can't come out and say it was this. So how do we deal with that language?
I don't know the legalities around that for the police, but I do know that when a perpetrator, an assailant, is actually spewing hate while they are committing the crime, it's a hate crime. And so, it begs the question, certainly for those of us in journalism, how to report it. But I think that you have to say it's hate when it's hate.
Yeah. And I think regardless of the language, you can't erase that reporting on it and talking about it is trauma or brings up people's trauma. That's inescapable. My hope is that for other, POC, other queer folks, when we have these conversations, that we allow ourselves to soften into vulnerability. I think that there is a lot of pressure to always be right or to always feel like you have the answers. And actually creating space to learn from each other, I think, is so important in moments like this.
And I think also that to find the strength in that vulnerability.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
I mean, we can be soft for a little bit?
Yes.
And on that note, Rebecca Carroll is cultural critic and editor of special projects at WNYC, and Tobin Lowe is co-host of the podcast Nancy. Thanks to you both for talking with me about this.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And we've been hearing your reactions to this act of violence.
My name is Mary. I live in suburban Philadelphia. I'm 64 years old. And I vividly recall my mother telling me stories about Hitler's rise to power. I've never been scared before like I am now. I'm pretty brave.
Hi, this is Helen. I'm so upset what's happening in Chicago. And myself also, I'm scared. I don't know what will happen for me and for my family.
Hi, this is Lisa. I'm calling from Portland, Oregon. As a Jewish woman whose great-great-grandparents and aunt and child, their daughter was killed in the Holocaust, and just as an American, just as a human, this hate, it's always going to be there, but our leadership have got to take a stand.
For many of you, this attack felt deeply personal.
My name is Sam. I'm from Portland. The attack really spoke to me as a queer person. Every day that we live out and proud in our communities, wearing bright, colorful clothing, we put ourselves in danger of those who want to erase us. People die in queer communities every day because of hate, and especially recently with the president allowing hate speech within his own party and within his own constituents to run rampant.
Hello, my name is Phoenix. I'm calling from Denver, Colorado, and I'm not fearful of my safety more so than I am my young black son's safety and black men, period. I'm more fearful of their safety because they are under constant attack by individuals who are afraid of them for their greatness. They have no other reason to be afraid of them other than that.
Hi, my name is Jen. As the mother of a child who identifies as bisexual and gender fluid, my reaction is, God help you if you lay a finger on my daughter.
Hi, this is Amisha from Denton, Texas. I'm currently thinking of ways in which I, as an African-American female, could maybe just move out of America, maybe give it a break for a while, maybe leave permanently.
We had an outpouring of responses to this story, and we really appreciate you weighing in. Stay with us. It's almost here, the most watched television event in the United States. This Sunday, the New England Patriots face off against the LA Rams in Super Bowl 53. But one thing viewers might not see during the game are players protesting against racial inequality. This year, we didn't see as much coverage of activism taken on by NFL players, but that doesn't mean it disappeared. Joining me now is Michael Fletcher, and he's a senior writer with ESPN's The Undefeated. Michael, thanks so much for being with us.
My pleasure.
So as we mentioned, you know, there were lots of players and a lot of folks in media coverage about taking a knee. There hasn't been as much coverage or at least visible representations of protesting. What kind of social justice activism, if any, have the players been involved in?
Well, there have been a few players who've continued kind of their on-field protests. You know, Eric Reed, a good friend of Colin Kaepernick, the former 49ers quarterback who launched all of this. You know, he played this season of Carolina and kneeled some and protested. And there have been a couple other players, Kenny Stills of the Dolphins and others. But for the most part, you're right. I mean, there hasn't been as many on-field protests, and certainly the coverage has kind of receded as, you know, essentially the story, you know, got old for the press. But, you know, other players are doing other things. They're doing more off-field kind of direct hands-on social kind of justice work. You have the Players Coalition, which, you know, a group of players and former players that has been kind of derided by some in Kaepernick's camp. But nonetheless, they've gotten tens of millions of dollars, $89 million from the NFL. And they've been doing work in various communities, you know, kind of a social work, essentially, trying to help uplift communities and that kind of thing. So I think the activism has shifted to kind of more direct action in some cases. I think the bulk of it, and you still have some on-field stuff.
So I was going to ask you about the on-field stuff, because I feel like there were, you know, after the Kaepernick fiasco, if you will, and everything that led, that came after that, there were lots of people who said they were going to sit it out, that they were not watching the league this year. And yet I'm seeing lots of people who are watching football. Did those more visible protests make a difference in getting people's awareness up about the issue? And since there aren't as many today, could that be part of the reason why people are still watching the game?
That's interesting. And when you start looking at viewership and things like that, you kind of start to understand the dilemma of NFL owners. The polling numbers I've seen show that you have a block of people who did stop watching football. But it's interesting, more people who are kind of opposed to the protest movement, more of those people stopped watching football than people who are aligned with the protesters. So that's an interesting kind of dilemma. So it gets complicated when you start looking at kind of the impact of the protests.
And I'm wondering also, we've sort of glossed over Colin Kaepernick here, but he really started this. And I'm wondering if the fact that he hasn't been able to get signed, he's still, you know, out there. He did this this Nike ad, but other than that, he's not playing. And I'm wondering if that has maybe dissuaded other players from being as open with this sort of powerful symbolism that comes with taking a knee on the field.
You know, you would think it has to, right? And you look at Kaepernick, he was kind of in a unique position. He was basically, at one point, he was one of the top stars in the NFL. He had signed a contract that if he had been paid out on it, he would have earned over $120 million. As it was, he was not cut, but he bowed out of his contract. But he still collected more than $40 million. Most NFL players don't have that kind of financial freedom. They're working, you know, the average NFL career, I believe, is 3 years. The salaries are much lower for these guys. You know, not that many players make, you know, over $1 million a year. So it's tough for them, right? It's hard. And I'm sure there had to be some kind of chilling effect when Kaepernick didn't get signed, because here he was, kind of a guy. Okay, he had sort of receded from his star kind of peak, but he was still a well-known, well-paid quarterback, and he suffered for it. So there had to be some chilling effect. But I think other players also, there's also a feeling of we need to move on. There's another group of players, like, you know, I mentioned this Players Coalition, the Malcolm Jenkins of the Philadelphia Eagles is a leader of that. And those people felt like, you know, we don't necessarily want to protest in perpetuity. We have actual goals we're trying to achieve. And the goal isn't to protest. And the goal isn't necessarily to get Kaepernick back in the game, even though they support that. They will argue that the goal is bigger than the plight of one guy. And the goal, you know, has to do with the reasons Kaepernick kneeled in the first place. The rampant police brutality, the rampant racial and economic inequality we see around our country. What can we as a people do about that? And how can, you know, in, from their perspective, how can we as NFL players use our platform to try to make an actual dent in the problem?
So outside of the sort of the larger goals, as you said, what started this whole thing was wanting to shed a light or shine a light, if you will, on police brutality against Black Americans. But even within the league, there are lots of issues. And I'm wondering if NFL players are also, you know, trying to use this as a moment to organize around their issues within the league, whether that be pay or whether it be racial representation. I mean, we know that there have been coaches and quarterbacks in particular who the lack of diversity in that is pretty stunning. What are some of the issues internally that these players are trying to work out?
Yeah, man, I think you touched on a couple of them. One is it's really pay and kind of job security, economic security, if you will. And also, we, you know, obviously we hear a lot about the health issues, and these things are kind of operating on separate tracks. But I believe that the Kaepernick protests have kind of lent fuel to them. You know, we hear story after story about former players who have CTE, concussion syndrome, and aren't able to function later in life. And if you look at pro sports, you know, football players, you know, granted, okay, they make a lot of money at a young age, but their careers, as I mentioned, are short, and their contracts are not guaranteed.
We mentioned Sunday's the big game. Do you expect any surprises? I mean, even when it comes to entertainment, there were stars that decided not to do it, to perform at the game. Are we expecting any protests or any surprises?
Well, you know, I'm not down in Atlanta to know. I don't think so, but I wouldn't be surprised if even if there's a protest. I'm not sure of, like, the actual individuals on each roster, kind of where they stand on this. But, you know, they could well be. And as we know, the halftime show has been a big controversy. Big stars, Cardi B, Rihanna, they refused to perform. We had Amy Schumer decide not to do any Super Bowl-related commercials, and this is all because of Kaepernick. So clearly, Kaepernick's plight hangs over the game, and we'll see how it all plays out there.
Michael Fletcher is a senior writer with ESPN's The Undefeated. Michael, thanks so much for your reporting.
Oh, thank you.
What kind of society do we want to live in? Mm-hmm. Are we comfortable with a society where someone can have a personal helipad mm-hmm. while this city is experiencing the highest rates of people experiencing homelessness mm-hmm. since the Great Depression? Mm-hmm. Should those two things coexist mm-hmm. at the same time?
That's Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez speaking at an event in New York City on Martin Luther King Day. Just one day later, the annual retreat for the world's ultra-rich and well-connected, known as the World Economic Forum at Davos, began. And not surprisingly, Ocasio-Cortez's proposed 70% marginal tax rate was on everyone's mind, including billionaire Michael Dell, the CEO of Dell Technologies.
Michael Dell, do you support this?
I just want to say I'm thrilled that they're asking.
Wow.
And then Howard Schultz, billionaire and former CEO of Starbucks, announced he's considering an independent candidacy for president. Schultz quickly made a distinction between his vision of America and that of many Democratic frontrunners.
I'm not a Democrat. I don't affiliate myself with the Democratic Party, who's so far left, who basically wants the government to take over health care, which we cannot afford, the government to give free college to everybody, and the government to give everyone a job, which basically is $40 trillion on the balance sheet of $21.5 trillion. We can't afford it.
Here with me now is Anand Giridharadas, journalist and author of Winners Take All, The Elite Charade of Changing the World. Anand, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me, despite my not being a billionaire.
That, you know, I'm not either, so I guess we can kind of sit this one out, I guess.
Give it time.
I don't know. I'm working on it, you know. I'll tell you, I mean, even a billion, million, you know. But we do know that there are lots of billionaires who are suddenly interested in politics, and I'm wondering one in particular, Schultz, why did his announcement strike such a nerve?
I actually think, you know, like many rich people who live in bubbles, you know, the last thing he knows is kind of what's going on. And he couldn't have announced at a worse moment, just the way Davos couldn't have happened at a worse moment. For the first time in my lifetime, and as someone who's been reporting on this for years, we are actually having a new conversation in America about plutocracy and billionaires, right? The question of whether we should even have billionaires, I'm not sure I can recall a moment where that's been an admissible question in American life? It's a question I've been raising on my book tour for the last few months. And even, I would say, 4 or 5 months ago when I was raising that question, there, the gasps were, you know, maybe a little outnumbered the applause. And I saw that changing over the last few months. And you had a wave election. You have people like Congresswoman Ocasio-Cortez raising these questions, people like Elizabeth Warren raising these questions. And then you have these out-of-touch people going to Davos, celebrating their own self-interested magnanimity, making the world a better place, even as they continue to hoard more and more of the world's wealth and power. And so when Howard Schultz gets in and says, you know, I'm the solution, I, a billionaire, am the solution to a bad billionaire president, in his view and in my view, who I think was in many ways occasioned and rose to power because an entire billionaire class had left so many Americans shut out of the American dream. The idea that billionaires are going to save us from a billionaire who only rose to power because of the, you know, the predation of billionaires is so laughable. And I think if he was a little less rich, he might be a little more in touch with kind of where people are in this country.
Well,
right
and
now.
And I also wonder, I mean, part of the reason why we wanted to talk about this was because it's one thing to be a billionaire, though I personally, and you obviously, Anand, we don't know what that feels like, but it's one thing to be a billionaire, and it's another thing to say things that that these folks have been saying, which is, you know, we just came out of a government shutdown where thousands of Americans were struggling to make ends meet. So to me, there seems to be a real disconnect between saying or telling Americans that, you know, Medicare for all is too expensive or taxing the uber wealthy doesn't make sense, when we're in a moment when Americans have clearly shown that many of us are working paycheck to paycheck.
I think at the heart of the problem is that there's a context in America in which billionaires have had way too much power. They've way over-indexed the amount of power they should have over the last generation.
And why do they think they can connect with average Americans, too? I mean, to be president would assume that you need to connect with your constituency.
And look how disconnected. So you had a couple comments, first of all, which I just want to condemn simply. I mean, Howard Schultz has now used the phrase un-American or non-American twice in the first 24 hours of his kind of trial balloon, right? He called Kamala Harris's ideas un-American. He called, you know, some of the ideas emerging from Congresswoman Ocasio-Cortez's office un-American. You have Michael Bloomberg getting out there, also sort of, you know, flirting in his awkward, flirtatious way with running himself. And he's sitting there saying, you know, Medicare for all would bankrupt America, bring the country to its knees. You know, these kind of wealth taxes would turn us into Venezuela. I mean, it's so out of touch. What kind of patriot? I'm a patriot. So I actually think America has the fortitude to do what basically most other Western countries have, which is have a national health insurance system. I actually don't think we would be brought to our knees.
I'm just concerned here about the crossover between those who succeed in corporate and private industry in a sort of profit-driven model, who now want to translate those skills, if you will, to what should be not a profit-driven model, is running the government and making sure Americans
yes.
are okay.
It's the closing of an amazing generation-long loop. So this began, and you know, I wrote Winners Take All because I wanted to understand how the rich and powerful had kind of conquered American life. And the loop goes back to the 80s, where they had the Reagan Revolution, get rid of government, get rid of social services, cut taxes, etc. But if they had only stuck with that, they would have, you know, come across as mean-spirited and callous. So what they've done in more recent years, the people who've benefited from this kind of winners-take-all economy, is that they've turned around and stolen the traditional kind of left vocabulary of changing the world, making it a better place. You have Mark Zuckerberg, one of the great monopolists of the modern era, someone who's actively compromised American democracy itself, talking about changing the world, building community, liberating mankind. You know, and every Wall Street bank that caused a financial crisis has this CSR program to empower women or help, you know, minority communities. And I think these billionaire presidential campaigns, and there are, you know, others probably still to come, are testimony to this idea. In a way, the final stage, we already have one maybe billionaire president, and now we have these billionaires who think that only a billionaire can save us from a billionaire. And it's actually high time, in my view, that we regained our confidence as a brave and proud people to make change ourselves and not wait for, you know, billionaire sugar daddies and sugar mommies to make it for us.
Anand Giridharadas is the author of Winners Take All, The Elite Charade of Changing the World. Thanks, Anand.
Thank you for having me.
In 2019, the way we watch television is very different than it was just 10 years ago. But one thing that doesn't seem to be changing are barriers to entry for certain communities. According to UCLA's latest Hollywood diversity report, in the 2015 to 2016 TV season, Latinos accounted for only 5% of on-screen roles in digital shows, which is one reason why, three seasons in, Netflix's sitcom One Day at a Time remains all too unique of a show.
This is it. This is life, the one you get to go and have a ball.
The show centers on the Cuban-American Alvarez family, single mother Penelope, her two kids Elena and Alex, and grandmother Lydia, played by the legendary Rita Moreno. In the season 3 premiere, the Alvarezes experience a death in the family, but still find plenty of humor along the way.
It's your tia Ophelia. She's dead.
Oh my God, Mommy, that's terrible. Who is she again?
Behind the scenes of One Day at a Time is a writer's room that's about 50% Latino and more than 50% women. And overseeing the entire production is Gloria Calderon-Kellett, the show's executive producer and co-showrunner. And ahead of the show's third season premiere on February 8th, I sat down with Calderon-Kellett to talk about her show and why it has such a devoted fan base.
I think largely it's seeing yourself on screen. I think that there is a real starvation of positive portrayals of Latinos right now on television. And still, the majority of that are largely stereotyped, you know, gangbangers and drug dealers and negative, criminalized versions of the Latinx experience. And so, as someone who did not grow up in, you know, any form of gang violence or, you know, I just had two parents that were immigrants but came here, and I grew up in a very Cuban community. And then when I moved to San Diego, a very Mexican and a Latin American community, and these were all hardworking, good people that had kids and loved their families. And then to see that never reflected on television was odd. And then you think about people in parts of the country that have never met a Latino person, and their only experience of us is this very damaging experience that they're seeing on their televisions. You know, that's rough. And I think that that does really affect how people see this community. And so to be able to have a job where I'm getting to tell stories about my family and honor them, but also show my community that I see us and that I can positively portray us is incredibly powerful. I'm so grateful to be able to do it.
What about with the actual content? It's one thing to get the casting. It's another thing to really tackle different types of issues. One, some are these really intense societal issues that we're seeing happening today. One of the shows that you guys did focuses on toxic masculinity, for example.
Abuelita, you are an enabler of toxic masculinity.
Oh, please, I do not enable toxic men. I clean Papito's room twice a day.
No. It's how society has encouraged men to define their maleness as being aggressive, unemotional, sex-obsessed.
You're just describing a man.
How do you tackle a topic like that without hitting viewers over the head, but also getting the point across?
I think it really starts from the characters. You know, we had written these characters that felt very real to me. You know, my mom is much more traditional, old-school Catholic Cuban. First generation, and I am in the middle. I'm sort of a moderate. I like some of the old traditional stuff, and I embrace some of this new stuff that I'm learning from this next generation. And then, you know, we have a lot of queer writers in the room as well who are educating me daily on how to be a better ally, how to embrace this next generation and what they care about and what is important to them. And so we really have these conversations in the room from our actual points of view, and the conversation and the fighting and the misunderstandings and the all of that stuff that happens in the room are the texture of what appears on screen. We really just take those conversations and misunderstandings and jokes that we make amongst one another and put them, filter them through the characters.
Getting into the writer's room is hard enough. Directing and getting in front of the camera, getting in front of and behind the camera is no easy feat. And you have been able to do both this season. Tell us a little bit about that experience. I mean, I can tell you, I'm sitting here as a national syndicated radio host in public radio, and I'm one of the few Latinas in this role, if any. So, you know, so I mean, I get asked the question a lot. I'm going to lob it over to you. How does it feel? And what did you do? And how does it work?
It's so interesting because on one hand, it feels wonderful, right? You're like, oh, my gosh, I got to do it. And I very much want to crush it so that it will open more doors. And then on the other hand, it's wildly frustrating to be the first because you're like, how is this possible? How is it possible that I managed to make it through? And how did I get so lucky? I will say it's wonderful. It's wonderful to be able to finally have this opportunity, but I feel like I had to create, you know, when people are like, how did you become a director? I said, well, go create a show.
Mm-hmm.
And then you get to, yeah, go create it. So that has to be how I tell people to do it because that was my way in. That was my shot is that I got to create it for myself.
Yeah, no, I agree. I wonder, I mean, there is something to be said for institutional change for sure. And that is slow and often long and coming, but I do believe in also trying to create it and shake some trees on your own. Tell us about the audience just before we wrap.
The audience is amazing. It's amazing. But I will say the first audience is the writer's room because, you know, first season we talked about, I would say things in Spanish a lot. And if it would get a laugh from the white guys, I'd put it in because I felt like, growing up, I didn't know what certain things were. I was a, you know, Cuban American girl watching white television and having to place myself in those situations. So I know the opposite can be true because I did it the other way, right? But the Spanish and the language was a thing that I really didn't want to translate. I really wanted people to Google words if they liked it or rewatch if they wanted to try to translate it because that's what I would do. I would take out my encyclopedia if I didn't know certain words. And so there's like it becomes a bit interactive in that experience. And it also felt more authentic to be able to just have them rattle off Spanish here and there. In fact, Phil Lord, who's a fellow Cuban American who did Into the Spider-Verse and a million other things, we were talking this week about this very thing because he didn't translate the Spanish and Into the Spider-Verse. And he said people loved the authenticity of that. And they're talking about that. It's a talking point for them. So it adds to the flavor and texture of the show, which I love. And then, you know, you have people that are now Googling what certain Spanish words mean, which is really, really fun. But our audience is mixed. You know, sometimes they'll be laughing because they just know it's funny theoretically. And sometimes I remember when we did a Vicks VapoRub joke that all the Latinos in the audience started laughing. But then on Twitter, people will be like, that's how my family feels about Windex, or that's how my family feels about X, Y, and Z. So they were able to see something that was very specific to the Latinx community and see that they had something in their own community that was similar so that they could understand the experience. And it speaks to Norman's entire process. He feels like specificity is universal and that, you know, we are all having this human experience together. And the more we can kind of focus on our common humanity, the better the world will be. And I couldn't agree more.
I forgot. You also get to work with Norman Lear, Gloria.
Yes.
I mean, this is like a really...
It's an embarrassment of riches. It really is. There is not a day that I am on that set that I don't feel so incredibly grateful to the journey that my grandparents took in making the very difficult decision to send their children to the United States and that I get to give this show to my family as a gift for their incredible sacrifice. This is really my love letter to them.
Gloria Calderon-Kellett is the executive producer and co-showrunner for One Day at a Time. Gloria, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And that's our show for today. I'll be out on vacation next week, but the wonderful Matt Katz will be filling in, so be sure to tune in to hear him. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.